Hello, everybody. Today we are going to begin to break down the mystery of Missing 411. Missing 411 refers to a series of unexplainable disappearances across North America. As we're going to see throughout the series, some of these cases are so bizarre that it's hard to even speculate what could have happened to these people. And yes, I did say series because, as you're going to see, this topic is so wide and interesting that this is only the beginning of our analysis of it. Every year, along North America's national parks, landmarks, roadways, and cave systems, the most unexplainable disappearances take place. So across this video and future installments of Missing 411, we're going to look at several of these cases, we're going to look at different theories and correlation between them, and hopefully we can begin to unpack the mystery of the American wilderness. And today, we're going to do that with a special guest, but more on him in a moment. But for now, grab a seat and get ready to go on a journey of American terror. But before I ruin your day with more crazy conspiracy theories and disturbing mysteries, let's talk about something that's disturbingly good, and that is today's sponsor, the home of audio entertainment, Audible. Audible has a near endless selection of audiobooks, podcasts, stand-up routines, live shows, and whatever else you like. And with your Audible Plus membership, every month you will receive access to something from Audible's premium catalog, meaning that once a month you will be able to pick whatever bestseller you want for free and then keep it forever. Not only that, but with your Audible Plus membership, you will be granted access to Audible's Plus catalog. And from there, you can dive into horror series and mystery thrillers to your heart's content. For example, I really wanted to listen to the book, The Picture of Dorian Gray. So I think to myself, I wonder if Audible will have that. And not only did they have that, I get to go through and then cherry pick whichever narrator's voice I like the best by listening to Audible's selected samples and then getting whatever version I want. And sure enough, Audible had me covered because my favorite version comes with their Plus membership. And thanks to Audible Originals, you can find some amazing content that you literally can't find anywhere else. And if you're like me and constantly on the go, you can download the Audible app and listen anytime, anywhere. So why not get started to Audible today? And right now you can do that for free. That is right, you can get this entire offer for free for an entire month. So if you go to the link in the description at audible.com/Wendigoon or text Wendigoon to 500-500, you will be able to try Audible for free for 30 days. So get in on this fantastic offer that you can't find anywhere else. Once again, that's audible.com/Wendigoon or text Wendigoon to 500-500 to start today. Thank you all so much for watching the ad. Thank you so much to Audible for sponsoring the video. It really does mean the most. Hope you all check them out. Link is in the description and we are back to the video. We are going to go ahead and get into it, but as always, thank you for watching. Now, as mentioned earlier, Missing 411 describes unexplainable disappearances within the North American continent. Now, at the moment, I am more of a hobbyist into Missing 411. I enjoy reading the stories and then relaying that information to you all. However, my friend is what I would consider to be an expert. Not only has he done firsthand research into the individuals and locations mentioned, but he routinely harasses government employees to get more information about the cases, which is definitely something I can get behind. And that friend is my fellow host of the Weird Bible Podcast and host of the Lore Lodge, Aiden Mathias. So rather than having myself give you a rundown of what constitutes a 411 case and giving you the commonalities that I found between them, I'll just let the expert do it.
Thank you, Isaiah, you beautiful, beautiful giant man. My name's Aiden Mattis, and I am the host of The Lore Lodge, where we talk about history, folklore, the paranormal, religion, and, of course, the Missing 411 phenomenon. When Isaiah first asked me to be involved in this video, my immediate response was, "Who do you think you are to approach me in such a manner?" In reality, I was actually quite grateful because Isaiah and I are good friends and I like helping. The exact thing that he asked me to go over, however, was the Missing 411 profile. What makes a case a Missing 411 case? Because, of course, we're not just dealing with any missing persons case here. Cases that have obvious explanations, such as foul play, self-harm, or, you know, animal predation, something like that, those don't get researched as Missing 411 cases. They're actually ruled out immediately upon there being a simple explanation. So, a Missing 411 case is, by definition, a case for which there is no rational explanation. And on top of that, there are a number of factors that go into this that David Politis, the guy who started writing the books on the missing 411 phenomenon, the guy who coined the term, which, by the way, in case you're wondering what missing 411 means, missing is obvious, it's missing persons cases, and 411 is the dial code for calling for information. It's the information hotline. So missing 411 is missing information. The information being exactly what happened to these people who went missing and were found in unusual circumstances, or who were found dead, or who were not found at all. So, David Politis put together his profile points. Well, what do these cases generally have in common? There's a number of things, and while not every single one will apply to every single case, a majority of them usually do. So what I'm going to do for you here is I'm going to go through, I'm going to explain the profile points, and I'm going to give you quick little explanations regarding cases that fit those profile points so that Isaiah can get on with the rest of the video with you having a solid understanding of exactly what he's talking about. There are 12 primary profile points regarding missing 411 cases, one of which is that they are clustered, usually. There will be a number of cases that occur in one specific area, and there are 52 of these clusters across the continental United States and Canada. The other 11 missing 411 profile points are as follows. Most of these cases occur in national parks. Many of them involve elevation changes. A lot of them occur around bodies of water. People will often go missing near berry shrubs or boulder fields. Generally, the boulder fields are granite. A lot of people who are found won't have any memory of how they went missing or even the time during which they were. They'll just suddenly show up somewhere and not be able to explain what happened. Many people who are found are missing clothing. Some people attribute this to paradoxical undressing or heat stroke, but in a lot of these cases, the weather isn't extreme enough for either one of those to occur. People will sometimes go missing in swamps and end up found in places that they couldn't have possibly gotten to, or that they couldn't get there within the time frame that they went missing and were found. In a lot of cases, one of the utterly confounding things is that the dogs that are brought in, the bloodhounds, can't actually find a scent trail, even when they're given someone's boot or something like that. They're just completely incapable of actually picking up the trail, or the trail will lead somewhere that doesn't actually make sense. Oftentimes, these cases will involve young children. Of course, that's not something that can necessarily be attributed with all of them, because many of these cases are adults, but when the cases do involve young children, there are many commonalities between them. And an honorable mention in terms of profile points here is that, not a majority necessarily, but a rather large minority of these cases involve people of German descent. That one probably doesn't have to do with anything, but it is weird.
Aiden's going to continue to help out throughout the rest of this series, so you'll definitely be seeing more of him. But if you're interested in checking out his channel, The Lore Lodge, or the podcast that him and I do together, The Weird Bible Podcast, it will be the second link in the description just below the ad. In future videos, I want to group together cases that have some common ground and maybe theorize on what that could mean. But for now, again, this is mostly an introduction, I want to go through some of the ones that I find the most terrifying. As a matter of fact, Aiden and I would both like to do that, so I'll let him have the first go.
Another one of these common points, elevation change. People will be found after going missing at 4,000 feet, and they'll be found at 9,000 feet, with really no explanation for how it is that they got there. And a case that exemplifies that is that of Bobby Bizzup. Bobby went missing in Rocky Mountain National Park. He was at camp, it was a Catholic boys' camp, and all that could really be discovered is that he was fishing in a local stream, and then the counselors called everybody back for food. One counselor saw Bobby Bizzup say he was coming down, he had his fishing rod, turned around, went down to the bottom of the mountain, and when he got there, he realized Bobby was nowhere to be seen. He just wasn't there. So they launched a search, and they could not find Bobby anywhere until eventually they found him several miles away, much higher up on the mountain, and all they found of him was his hearing aids, some of his clothes, and fragments of his skeleton. They didn't find anything other than that.
While it's very common for no remains to be found in a 411 case, sometimes when they are found, the case becomes all the more bizarre. An example of that is the instance of Charles McCuller. In 1974, an 18-year-old Charles McCuller was known for taking hiking trips throughout the Northwest United States. For about a year, Charles would hike out to these remote locations, take several wildlife pictures, and then work his way back. He was rather experienced, as is common with several 411 cases. and it wasn't uncommon for him to spend a few days by himself in the mountains before returning to civilization. So in 1975, when a 19-year-old Charles told his friends that he was going to hike to the Crater Lake National Park in Oregon, they didn't think much of it. That was until Charles didn't return for 3 days when he was only supposed to be gone for 2. So his friends called the police and an investigation soon followed. After performing an investigation, it seems the last person to see him alive was a park ranger who gave him a ride on January the 30th. That park ranger dropped Charles off at the trail he intended to follow. Some reports from that day say that Charles was spotted up to a 45-minute drive away just walking along the side of the road. And some other reports say that they saw someone matching Charles' description trudging through 5 feet of snow. However, the only one that can be confirmed is again that park ranger's testimony of taking him to the trailhead. A massive search was mounted for Charles, however, it was made difficult to do any searching because of 12 feet of snow recently left by a snowstorm. Not only that, but after the case began, for some reason, the FBI became involved. The FBI only involves themselves with cases if a kidnapping or foul play is suspected. However, at this time in the investigation, it was just a guy who took too long to be on a hiking trip. To this day, it's not really explained why the FBI involved themselves. Especially because the evidence was that there was no evidence. The guy had disappeared without a trace. For months, nothing could be found, and even after all the snow had melted, there was still no evidence of Charles being anywhere. That was until October the 1st of 1976, nearly 2 years since his disappearance. On that day, two hikers found a backpack lying in the woods about 12 miles from the spot where Charles was originally dropped off. Within the backpack, the two hikers found keys to a Volkswagen, which after they gave it to the police, was a match to Charles' vehicle. So now that there was a lead, a search began at the location the backpack was found. And shortly thereafter, Charles' remains were discovered in the nearby Bybee Creek. And from there is where it gets weird. Charles' jeans were found sitting upright on a log with no other articles of clothing lying around it. Obviously, Charles hadn't gone hiking into the woods, bare-chested, just wearing his blue jeans, so his coat, shirt, and other undergarments were nowhere to be found. The only other article of clothing that was there was Charles' socks, which were tucked into the bottom of the jeans' pants legs. The jeans also had the belt and buttons undone, implying that whoever took them off had done so voluntarily. Upon investigation, remember the two socks I mentioned being in the pants legs of the jeans? Well, the socks contained various feet bones, and inside of the jeans were snapped shin bones. And then located in a pile about 12 feet away from the log were the skeletal remains of Charles McCuller. Due to the weathering and effects of nature, everything was dismantled and fragmented. However, enough of a dental record could be made to confirm his identity. However, despite finding his bodily remains, nothing else was located. None of his equipment, his boots, or any other articles of clothing were ever found. Even more bizarre is that the location this was found in is an insanely remote part off the trail, meaning that if Charles was lost and then trying to find his way through the snow, there would be no reason for him to essentially scale an icy mountainside, only to put himself in a more remote and dangerous location. Keep in mind, at the time he went missing, everything was covered in several feet of snow as well. That specific location where he was found was originally suggested to go look back during the original search. However, they couldn't get any men or snowmobiles up there, so they figured reasonably there's no way Charles could have got up there. So what force compelled Charles to climb to his final resting place? And perhaps more importantly, what force put him there? There are cases of what's called paradoxical undressing, or whenever someone gets extremely hot or extremely cold, they begin to take off their clothes in a state of delirium. And while that would make sense for Charles in this case, why were his feet and legs still within his clothing? Or part of his legs still inside of his clothing? And then you have questions about where the boots went and why the top part of his body was separated from some of the parts of the lower part of his body. And even if you were to say an animal came and caused the disfigurement that the rescuers would later find, then how were the jeans still undone, upright, sitting on a log as if nothing bad had happened? It's a mystery to this day and one of the cases that make the 411 so compelling.
As I said before, many of these cases involve young children, and it's not that they're young children that makes it odd, it's that they're young children who are then found in places they really shouldn't be. One example of this is Keith Parkins. Keith Parkins was a 2-year-old who went missing in Ritter, Oregon. Now, Ritter is an unincorporated community in rural Oregon, and it's very close to Umatilla National Forest. Keith was out playing with his brothers on his family's cattle ranch. Eventually, when they got called in for lunch, they noticed that he was missing, so they launched a search for him. A few hours later, 4 miles away, they found footprints, and then they had to follow those footprints for another several hours before eventually the next day they found him face down on the ground, covered in scratches, alive, 12 miles from where he went missing. His explanation for the scratches was that a cat scratched him, but he had no explanation for how he covered 12 miles in less than 24 hours. And of course, you know, people wanted to see, is that even possible? So Les Stroud from Survivor Man tried to do the exact same hike, tried to cover the same distance, and he could not do it. So to be clear, I want to really drive that point home. A guy whose job is that they drop him in difficult terrain, and all he does is try and make his way to the extraction zone. He couldn't do this. So the idea that a 2-year-old feasibly could cover 12 miles of rough country in less than a day, it's just straight up impossible. But what about the ones that aren't necessarily just forests? Well, one of the profile points is swamps. And a case that had quite a few people baffled is the case of Rowan Grifton, who went missing in a swamp in 2010. Rowan was 2 years old, and he was at a family party at his grandmother's house, which is directly across the street from Barden State Wildlife Management Area. Now, that's not a national forest, but it is a state wildlife management area. New York is weird about their wildlife management areas. When we were doing our investigation on Tom Messick, the State Game Service would not speak to us. Rowan was playing with a cat, and then the cat ran off into the woods. Rowan chased the cat and was eventually discovered to be missing. They launched an immediate search of the area, and then when they couldn't find him, they called in help from the authorities. They searched for the rest of the afternoon before deciding to close down the search for the night because it just wasn't safe and they weren't going to make any progress. So, the next day, when they went out searching again, they did actually find him pretty quickly because they called out for him and he called back. But he was not found by the initial search group. He was found by a splinter group that decided to go check out a swampy area 3 miles away. All Rowan could tell people when they found him clinging to a tree in the center of a pond in the swamp that this 2-year-old boy could not have possibly swam to. Oh, and by the way, he was dry. All he could tell them was that he was scared of the cows, and the cows drove him out to this tree. There were no cows in the area. Rowan could give no other explanation of how he got there, and as I said, there weren't any cows.
One of the more interesting details, at least to me, about 411 cases is how they often happen to people who are incredibly prepared for whatever's happening. And it creates a near state of panic that if this could happen to them, then it could happen to anyone. And for an example of that, look no further than Aaron Hedges. Aaron frequently hiked a mountain range ominously known as the Crazies, located in the northern Rocky Mountain range of Montana. On September 3rd of 2014, a 38-year-old Aaron went out on a hunting trip with two of his friends. Him and his friends did this all the time. They would go out on horseback, bring all their gear on a pack mule, and then camp out for several days as they hunt big game. As a matter of fact, they were so experienced at doing this that Aaron and his friends had mapped out several of the trail routes on their own and even set up these small waypoints that had supplies and camping gear in case they needed any on their trip. So if you're confident enough in your hiking abilities that you'll leave thousands of dollars of gear in the middle of safe houses that you built dozens of miles up mountainsides, you're probably pretty good at it. While moving up the mountain on September the 5th, the mule that was carrying everyone's gear became spooked, and whenever it jumped, it caused Aaron's sleeping bag to fall off its back and down the mountainside. Now, it gets very cold in the Rockies at night, however, this wasn't a problem because, as mentioned earlier, they had waypoints set up with spare supplies. So on September the 5th, Aaron began to travel by himself to one of the waypoints a few miles down the trail. This was towards a location known as Sunlight Lake. I cannot stress this enough, this was a trail that Aaron was very familiar with. He had built several permanent camping sites on it and left the group with a GPS, a walkie-talkie, a cell phone, a bow and arrow, and a gun. He began to walk away from the two others, saying that he would be back by nightfall, and Aaron was never seen again. Whenever Aaron didn't show up that night, the two didn't think that it was a big deal. They just figured he probably stayed in the safe house for the night. However, when there was no word from him the next day, they began to panic. Especially whenever they go to check his location on the GPS, because the day previous, they weren't able to get the GPS to show his location. And whenever the location did pop up, he was miles and miles away, completely off the map from the selected trail area. So the two come off the mountain and alert Aaron's wife, who then alerts the police, and a search begins on September the 8th. The first day, they looked with the whole nine yards. They had infrared cameras, they had about 20 dog teams scoping out the entire mountain, and helicopters flying everywhere trying to find Aaron. However, nothing was found the first day. But on the second day, something was found that raised more questions than it did answers. On the second day, while walking to the location to begin the search for that day, search crews stumbled across what seemed to be a makeshift campfire where it seems someone had tried to start a fire with a pack of cigarettes. Nearby this makeshift campfire was an empty water bladder, a pair of straps for a waistband for a hiking backpack, and a pair of boots, all of which belonged to Aaron. The boots were lying side by side, neatly standing up, as if someone had calmly taken them off and placed them next to the fire. But then, in the middle of the Montana cold, decided to not put them back on. And once again, this was in a location that wasn't even being searched because it had been completely searched the day before. Not only that, but it was further down the mountain than the location where Aaron would have gone missing. So for all this to have worked out, Aaron would have had to walk one direction for several miles for his GPS location to show up, walk the other way but then miss the group who was looking for him, and then attempt to start a fire one night in a location that was searched shortly thereafter, only to then take off his boots and try to walk through the cold barefoot. Not to mention the dog teams that were running around the entire place and can never pick up a scent. So despite this, which should have been a great break in the case, nothing else was found. At least, nothing was found for 9 months. Until in June of 2015, a hiker discovered the backpack of Aaron Hedges. Inside of this backpack, the hiker discovered a cell phone, a hunting vest, extra clothes, a hunting license, and several granola bar wrappers, all of which belonging to Aaron Hedges. However, a short distance from that backpack, and potentially the weirdest development of the whole case, the hiker found sitting on top of a rock a thermos and an open energy drink, the family later saying that this thermos belonged to Aaron. This location was on top of the mountain that not only had a very clear view of the ranch beneath, but also of a major roadway right in front of the ranch. And it seems that when Aaron was drinking from that thermos and the energy drink, he was just sitting on the rock watching the road and the farm in front of him. And despite another massive investigation from the spot that this gear was found, no remains were located. That was until 1 year later, when the skeletal remains of Aaron Hedges were finally discovered. They were lying about half a mile down the hillside from the location where his gear was found the year prior. This was about 6 miles from where the makeshift campfire and boots were discovered, and about 15 miles from the last place where his friend saw him. And to make it even more bizarre, the remains were found a few hundred feet from the road and the ranch. And just in case you thought we'd get any answers, there were no cause of death determined from the bones that were found. There was no trauma on any of the bones or any indications of an injury that could have led to his death. For all we know, he simply died there with no earthly explanation. So think about this case. An experienced hiker begins to walk to a location that he's incredibly familiar with. However, he walks the completely wrong direction and then comes back in the wrong direction before he decides to take his boots off, walk another 6 miles to a mountaintop where he calmly sits down and has a coffee and energy drink before he leaves his backpack. And it seems that he was not only energized from the drinks, but also the granola wrappers he was eating, walks half a mile and dies right before he hits the road. A lot of people online say that he passed into a different dimension, which, sure, I've got nothing better. It's a story that really makes you ask, what happens in the woods when we're not looking?
Some other cases I want to mention that they didn't really exemplify any of these individual profile points, but I thought that they were interesting, were those of Maurice Doc Demetz, who went missing while topaz hunting in Pike National Forest. He was there with his friend, and this is another case where this was a person who was physically disabled. He had a very time walking on his own. He was, I believe, 82 years old. So there just wasn't any way that he was really going anywhere fast. His friend, after a few hours, you know, went to check on him because they were just topaz hunting 50 yards from each other, and he checked on him a few times, but the last time he went to check, Maurice wasn't there anymore, and nobody at all could find him. There's no way this guy wandered off on his own, and they determined there was no motive for the guy who was with him to have killed him. So, very strange case. There's the case of Eric Lewis, who went missing while hiking, particularly climbing Mount Rainier. They were ice climbing. He and his two friends, they noticed that they hadn't heard anything from him in a while, and when they pulled on the rope that would have gone down to him, it was slack. Eric seemingly just disappeared off the side of the mountain. He had unhooked his carabiner, and that was the last thing anybody could figure out that he had actually done. His clothes and gear were found in a small ice cave a little bit down the mountain, and that was it. That was the end. They could not find him. And the ice cave either did not go back far enough or was not navigable enough for them to look into it. There's also the case of Paul LeMay, who went missing on Mount Marathon. Now, Mount Marathon is, of course, in Kenai Fjords National Park. So, he was running the Mount Marathon race. He was the last person to be running the race. He was seen very close to the finish line by the crew who were packing up. He decided he wanted to make it all the way and then come back down, and he was never seen. They searched all over the mountain, every side, and there was no evidence that he had ever left the peak. Finally, the case of Bart Schleyer, who went missing in Reed's Lake in the Yukon Territory. This was not in a national park or national forest, but it was in an extremely isolated area that you actually had to fly to. He was brought in via an amphibious plane, and then when the pilot returned to pick him up at the scheduled time, Bart was not there. There was no sign that he had actually been hurt or attacked while he was there, but he just disappeared. His food was still all packed up at the campsite. There was a bag that had an impression on it that made it look like somebody might have been sitting on it, leaning back, you know, maybe waiting for game to come along. And of course, Bart was a world-class hunter. This is a guy who would track and tag Siberian tigers. And, I mean, the idea that a bear in the Yukon would catch him off guard enough to kill him without any sign of struggle just doesn't make sense. On top of that, if it were a bear, a mountain lion, a pack of wolves, anything like that, they probably would have also gone for the food that was left at his campsite. Since that was untouched, it seems very unlikely that he was a victim of animal predation. So that just about covers all the profile points and a number of cases that exemplify them. Once again, I'm Aiden Mattis of the Lore Lodge. You can find us here on YouTube, and I'll toss it back to Isaiah to go over some more details.
A lot of the missing 411 cases are entirely unexplainable, not only because of the condition in which remains or some evidence was eventually found, but just in the way that the entire thing kicked off. And I want to end this set of stories with one such case, that case being of Garrett Bardsley. On August the 20th of 2004, Garrett was out with his father on a Boy Scouts camping trip. Garrett was 12 years old and was out with his father and Boy Scout troop on a weekend getaway. This was in the Uinta Mountains of Utah at a place known as Cubert One Lake. Now, in several of the cases that Aiden and I have talked about up until this point, it involves an experienced person going into an uncharted realm of nature or someone getting trapped in the harsh elements. However, this situation was neither of those things. The location where Garrett and his father were camping was essentially a sort of park. There were several lots that were set up where groups could come and pitch a few tents and have access to hiking trails and lakes to fish in, and everything was very close and very easygoing. Again, it was a common space to bring out campers so that they can have their first Boy Scout camping trip. All the trails were cut out and very clearly marked to the point it was essentially a sidewalk. And on top of all of that, Garrett had his wilderness survival training. So if anything did happen out here, it should essentially be a cakewalk. Garrett and his father walked to the lake that was just downhill from their camping spot. While they were fishing, Garrett slipped and fell into the water, soaking his pants and shoes. Garrett decided to walk back to the tent so that he could change, and then he told his father he would come back down in just a minute to continue fishing. His father didn't think anything of it, because not only, as I mentioned, were the trails clearly marked and it was all a very easy path to walk on, but the campsite was about 200 feet away from where they were currently fishing. If it wasn't for a little bit of tree cover, you could have a straight line of sight from the side of the bank to the campsite. The dad, being overly cautious, even directed his son as his son was walking away to stay on the marked path and followed him with his eyes until he got up to the tree line. Meaning, at the last point Garrett was seen, he could have been within like 50 feet of the tent. So Garrett's dad continued fishing, but after about 20 minutes, he thought it was odd that Garrett hadn't come back to join him. So his dad comes up to the campground to check, and it turns out that Garrett never made it back to the camp. And as a matter of fact, Garrett was never seen again, remains or otherwise. It seems in just a few brief seconds even that Garrett was walking through the tree line, something took him off the trail. Either his own curiosity or something in the woods or something by force got him to leave the clear path he was following. A massive search was mounted, and the only evidence of Garrett that was ever found was about half a mile off the trail in a granite boulder patch. One of his wet socks was discovered, simply lying there crumbled up in a massive field of rocks. Even from the location where the sock was found, the main road was a quarter mile away, and there were so many campsites and roads all around the area, it's almost as if Garrett, or whatever had Garrett, was purposefully avoiding people. And despite efforts from search and rescue, dog teams, and horseback riders searching the area, nothing was ever found. Not even the fishing pole that Garrett took with him. And to this day, nothing more is known of what happened to Garrett Bardsley, save for one lonely sock. With several of these 411 cases, it boggles the mind to even try to come up with some explanation. Of course, that doesn't mean everything that's labeled as a 411 case is completely unexplainable. A point could be made for several of these cases that it was just someone out hiking who got too far in over their head. Or someone who just got lost and then nature does what nature does. However, that doesn't explain some of the weird circumstances or some of the gear found or how the remains were uncovered. Another theory is that people say it could be a serial killer or the police covering up for some murder they don't want on the public record. But even then, in a lot of these cases, like that of Aaron Hedges, even if he was killed, then how did that person leave all the gear, evade search and rescue team, and get the remains in the places they were found? People tie a lot of these theories into government conspiracies and say that it all relates back to MKUltra. With a lot of these stories, people say that maybe the government has these top secret facilities set up in the middle of the woods, and if anyone finds evidence of it, they're wiped out and their body made to look like a mystery. And while that sounds crazy, with some of the stories you've probably heard today and will hear in the future, it's probably the most plausible. Perhaps some of the most interesting stories to me are stories of delirium and paranoia that sets in. Because while we can wrap our head around that in a physical sense, we understand that people can essentially go crazy. It's the things that made them go crazy and the reason for it that I find to be so enthralling. Because what power does the forest hold to drive a mind mad in such a small amount of time? Of course, several of the cases could be written off as the effects of a wild animal attacking someone or either discarding their pieces across a large distance, but that doesn't answer questions like the bones of Charles being found in his own socks. But then again, at that point, what does? If it's not a creature we know exists, what of one that we don't know exists? Whenever I hear about these stories, I often think about a lot of the ancient legends that have to do with the Rocky Mountains and the Appalachian Mountains. Stories of siren spirits that exist out in the woods that pull men into them only to never be seen again. And stories of creatures that rise up in the night and make men vanish from their tents only to be found horribly mutilated several days later. And while it may not be some siren spirit or monster of the woods, whatever did it then is surely still doing it now. Things like that are easy for me to forget because I grew up in the forest. It's always been something that I viewed as a friend or something personal to me that I've never really found scary, at least, you know, during the daytime. And since it's something I've always known, it's never been the unknown. And because of that, and since the unknown is where we derive most of our fear, it's never been something I've been afraid of. And because of that, it's easy for me to forget that there is this secret might and power that exists within the woods. Every single piece of it is alive, from the trees and the grass and the creatures that inhabit them, to even the air you breathe in, it feels electric. It's as if every moment that you stand within nature, You are existing within a living creature. And if you ever lose sight or respect of that, you may be the next victim. That's really what it boils down to, right? The fear of the unknown. That's why these stories terrify us and keep us up at night, because they seem to be so unexplainable. And as someone who's familiar with the mystique and the mystery of the forests, I never want to lose sight of why it's so alluring in the first place. And that's one of the reasons that I'm here right now. A few of you may be wondering why I've had a change of venue. And that's because I'm
at the ocean. If you're familiar with my channel, you know I'm deathly terrified of the ocean and everything to do with it. So to make it even worse for myself, I came out here at night and I'm not doing well. The reason that I came out here is because for me, the woods and the mysteries of the woods and everything associated with them don't really mean anything. The tide is coming up to my legs, okay? Because again, I was raised in it. To me, it's perfectly normal. However, something I am terrified of is the nature I don't know. See, I was never raised near the beach. I only came to the beach on vacation. To me, the ocean was a boogeyman I never interacted with, and it still is to some degree. But it's for that very reason that the ocean interests me as much as it does. Because in spite of how afraid I am of it, and in spite of how terrifying of it, it exists regardless. And it's so interesting to me, the terrors and the fascination that I can pull out of it. And in a sense, the ocean and the woods are one. It's all part of nature. It's all part of this great big beast that we're all living in, and we can't really explain, or we can't really... I swear I heard something run up. Oh, man. It's all part of something we can't wrap our heads around, and it exists in spite of how we feel about it. The reason I'm here is because as I go through this series and as I talk about Missing 411, I don't want to lose the terror or the majesty of these stories and why I feel they're so important. Because they're a blemish across our history of trying to figure out everything that we can't put together, and that blemish is nature itself. So if you're like me and the woods don't scare you, but this does, it's all part of the same beast. So as hopefully over the coming series we put some pieces together about what the secret of Missing 411 means, maybe we can get some closure on things like this. Probably not. I hate it. I'm incredibly nervous right now. But if you made it this far into the video, I just want to say thank you for watching. I am horrified right now. I think I'm actually here past curfew, and I'm not supposed to be here, and I keep hearing people walking around in the darkness, so I'm going to call this short, but I just want to say thank you so much for watching. Thank you all so much for checking this out. Thank you so much to Aiden for being a part of the video. Aiden's a fantastic guy. As I mentioned, his channel will be in the description, along with the podcast him and I do together about weird biblical topics. So if you like my weird biblical stuff, be sure to check us out over there, and check out Aiden's channel regardless. He's a great guy, and I really like what he's doing on the Lore Lodge. So that covers that. I will be continuing this. What I have in mind for upcoming episodes in the series is to take cases that involve caves, or to take cases that involve mountaintops and other weird anomalies. Something jumped. Other weird anomalies that exist between everything, and then trying to draw a through line between them. So we'll see how that goes. And again, this was mostly an introduction, but hopefully you enjoyed it. I'm excited for where the series is going. And keep your eye out. I may be visiting some locations, considering, as mentioned earlier, I live pretty close to a lot of the scares that happen. So we'll see how that goes. But for now, I just want to say thank you for watching. I hope that you enjoyed, and I will see you in the next one. Bye. This is horrific.